Dog Works Radio Network presents Mushing Radio, hosted by Robert Forto. Mushing Radio is about dog-powered sports, living in the Great White North, and mushing. Visit our website at mushingradio.com. Here is your host, Robert Forto.
Welcome, everybody. You are listening to Mushing Radio here on KVRF 89.5 in the Mat-Su Valley. We're also over on dogworksradio.com. You can find us on iTunes. Search for Dog Works Radio, as well as on social media. Searching under the same name, Dog Works Radio, my co-host, his name is Alex Stein. He can be found on Twitter. His handle is at Coldfoot Films, and you can find me at Robert Forto. And we are hosting today. I am here in Willow, Alaska, and my co-host is in, I assume, sunny California. Alex, how's it going?
It's going great, Robert, and it is indeed sunny here. I wish it were a little bit less sunny. It's been kind of a not a ridiculously hot summer, but it seems like it's getting hotter and hotter.
You know, it's hot here, too, this week. We're above 80 today, which is pretty dang warm up in this part of the country, and it's been that way for most of the week. It makes for a little bit of a heat wave for the sled dogs in this kind of weather.
Yeah, I can imagine that you have to be careful of not letting them get too much exercise and keeping plenty of water around for them. And, just like a human – wearing a very big coat, you want to make sure that these dogs who have big thick coats and are used to and perform better at very cold temperatures don't get too overheated.
Right. And just a quick dog grooming tip, since you mentioned that, if you do have double coated dogs like Siberians or Malamutes or Alaskan Huskies, and they're blowing coat or shedding like they do this time of year, it's best to get out there and brush those dogs out and get all that loose undercoat off so they can have a little bit easier time in this hot weather. It's definitely a big chore when you have 30-plus sled dogs like we do, but if you just have one running around the house and he is blowing coat, it will make him feel much better if he's out of there. So today, Alex, we're going to turn the tables a little bit, and we're going to interview you. We've talked a lot about you on the show, about how you found your interest in mushing and your documentary Mush the Movie that you made a few years ago. But I don't think we've ever had, at least since we've co-hosted, where we've gone into depth about talking about your experience in making movies. And that's what I'd like to do, because, you know, we have new listeners coming in all the time. And I want to make sure that we catch everybody up to speed. And even though you made that documentary several years ago, I think, like Gone with the Wind and other movies, it is a timeless classic. What do you think?
I love to be put in that company. I certainly could not object to that. I'm not sure that I would put it up there with Gone with the Wind, but I definitely appreciate doing it. And you know, just briefly to jump in here, this was very much for me a labor of love. And what I think you'll find when you talk to most people who make documentaries is that they choose subjects that they really feel passionate about. And part of the reason is that with the exception of a few very notable people like your Morgan Spurlocks or your Michael Moores, documentaries tend not to be very profitable. They tend to be things that people will work on for sometimes years. I've known people who've been working on documentaries for over 10 years that even when they do manage to sell them or get a theatrical or a DVD release, they don't make big money. This is not, you know, this is not the Avengers. This isn't Captain America. And that's a good and a bad thing. I would certainly be happy, and my wife would be happy if making documentaries were more profitable. But at the same time, anytime that you're dealing with something that is bringing in a lot of money, there are a lot of people trying to control it, trying to make sure that the message is what they want it to be as opposed to what you want it to be. And one of the things that's happened in filmmaking in general, and especially in documentary filmmaking over the last 10 years or so, is that the barriers to entry have not entirely disappeared, but the barriers to entry have been lowered considerably. And 20 years ago, if you wanted to go out and make a documentary that would look decent on a big screen, that would cost you tens or hundreds of thousands of dollars. And the equipment was very expensive, and dealing with the post-production was very expensive. Most of that has come down considerably. So we're now at the place where pretty much anyone with a couple hundred to a couple thousand dollars can go out and make a documentary. And that also is both good and bad.
Well, you know, Alex, I am really interested in getting some of this behind-the-scenes stuff. And if you guys have listened to this show for any length of time, you know that I love to ask our professional guests out there who's written books or made documentaries or things like that. I always like to find out about the nuts and bolts, and that's what I'm hoping to do today. For folks that are listening, this is going to be a two-part show. It's going to be about 20 minutes each. I'm getting ready to head down south for a couple of weeks, so we're going to pre-record a couple of shows here, and I thought it would be a great topic to interview Alex. And, you know, this is sort of on the heels of my two recommendations for the next shows. One that I just watched the other day, I won't give the recommendation yet, but the guy that made the documentary about him said that he spent 2 years to make a 15-minute documentary, and he did that over and over and over again, and that was his profession, to make these very short documentaries that he spent a considerable amount of time on. So I'm interested in finding out the process with Alex. So to jump right into this, Alex, what was your job before you found this passion to do a documentary about mushing? Did you have experience in the film industry? Were you a filmmaker before, maybe not with mushing? You know, give us a little bit of a backstory about your paycheck earning job versus the passion.
Sure. I've worked in the film industry for a long time, mostly on the other end. So I've done a lot of what's called development work, which is evaluating and strengthening projects, usually scripted projects. I've worked with a bunch of studios and a bunch of production companies. And probably over the past 15 years or so, have read, I would say, between 5 and 10,000 movie scripts. So
wow.
That's primarily where I came from. And that type of work is always involved in finding and strengthening the story. So I come at pretty much everything I do from a story standpoint. This isn't something that I set out to do consciously, but over the course of dealing with scripts and dealing with script analysis and script consulting and story consulting for many, many years, I developed this very instinctive and strong sense of what really constitutes a good story. And it is something that is, I think, very, very deep-seated within most of us as human beings. I mean, we all can remember sitting around and telling stories before we were all addicted to TV and watching DVDs and streaming things on Netflix. We would sit around campfires and we would tell stories, and families would have story time, and people would gather around tables and have meals and tell each other stories. We still do that, although now we also do a lot of sitting around and watching things on screens. So I think that is such an important thing. And it is so, it's something that is so prevalent that I think a lot of people underestimate how difficult it is to get a story that really works well. Because we've all been to out to dinner, or we've all been to a bar or somewhere and told someone a story. And if you've done that, sometimes you notice that, oh, wait, this story didn't really work. And as I was telling it, I realized there was something I should have said in the beginning. So it is basically a lot of those type of issues, just on a slightly larger scale.
So how did you get into the business, Alex? Did you go to college and study filmmaking? You know, what was that that formative work that got you involved in the industry today?
I moved out to California to be a writer, and I just had always, and I have had some success, not as much as I'd like, in writing things for film and TV. And I kind of fell into this. I had a friend who had been doing story analysis and said, oh, I think you'd be really good at this. And I think I read a couple of books, and I may have taken a class, although now I'm not sure if that's actually true that I took a class, or I just remember taking a class. But I eventually met people who were doing this, and I talked to them a lot, and I was able to get in at a company that was just starting, and so they were I think more impressed by my enthusiasm than they were noticing that I didn't have a lot of experience. And then I learned as I was doing it. I spent a lot of time talking to my bosses, talking to executives, talking about, well, what specifically is it when you have a script, what specifically is it that gets your attention or doesn't get your attention? And what I found is that it's sometimes what you might expect, but it's sometimes something totally different. I had a company that I worked for where the woman who ran the company was obsessed with the idea of the romance of men in uniform. And so there was one day where she just decided that she had to make a movie about that had the lead character who was a man in a uniform, like a cop or a fireman or a soldier or something like that. It didn't really matter to her. She just wanted the uniform. And, you know, secondarily, it had to be good. But that day, anything that she had seen that would have that was good and featured a lead character who was in a uniform, she was going to buy that. So, you know, it's odd and frustrating for a lot of my friends who are writers, because they say, I don't understand why this thing that is not very good gets bought or gets made, and my thing, which is good, doesn't. And one of the things I learned is that a lot of the time, it has to do with these intangible things that you could never possibly know, like this executive who suddenly was in love with the idea of a movie about a man in uniform.
So speaking of that, documentaries and films in general have a period of time, and documentaries in comparison, they spend a lot of time in film festivals, and a big part of that is reviews by other people, and you know where other folks are saying, is this good or is this bad or whatever. And I know in feature films, they will do test screenings of movies, and they will poll the people or however they take their critiques, and they will actually change parts of the movie based on that that polling. Can you tell us a little bit about that, and do you have experience with that in your own film?
I do. I was a development executive at HBO for a couple of years, and we used to do, when I worked there, we did extensive testing. Oddly, we did not use the testing to change things as much as we used the testing to see if the things that we really liked worked. The entire time that I was there, I'm not sure that we ever went back and changed something based on the testing, but it definitely was helpful in terms of identifying who the target audience should be. You know, for example, if there's a scene involving competitive ice skating, that is something that, and I still don't entirely understand this, women just adore. And we had a show that had a segment where there was ice skating, and they do what's called dial tests, where everyone has like a little dial in front of them, and you turn it up if you like the scene that's going on, and you turn it down if you don't like the scene. And whenever we would get to the ice skating, all of the women would turn their dials all the way up, and almost all of the men would turn their dials all the way down. So that's an extreme example, but there's a lot of things that you can learn in testing if you're a studio or if you have a big movie about what marketing you should use. Generally speaking, in the documentary world, there's not the time or money to do that. So I did a bunch of screenings for friends of mine, and that was actually much more interesting for me, experiencing sitting there with them as they watched it. They also gave me feedback after we were done, but that was less helpful than actually watching it with them. And when you do that, you notice things like a sequence that you've seen 100 times. Suddenly, when you're seeing it with people, they might get a little bit antsy, or you might realize, oh, I've thought that this was short, but this is really seems to be going on forever. So for me, it was much more valuable to be able to watch with people and then change based on, I guess, my intuition about what was going on with them based on their body language and how the sort of tone in the room changed at different points.
You know, I bring this up to parallel your documentary, again, not necessarily comparing it with the big movies, but when we talked about the testing, Alex, back in the early days, in 1980s, the studio changed the movie Pretty in Pink because of that testing. I guess the love interest was one person, and the audience didn't agree with it, so they ended up changing the movie to another person. And just very recently, in the movie Zootopia, they did the same thing. The movie was originally about, the main character was the fox, and it did not agree well with the audience, and they ended up changing it to the bunny rabbit, to the female character. So I thought that was pretty interesting that they will just change based on the audience. But I want to ask you, Alex, and again, this show, this first part of this show was to get mainly background. Then we're going to jump into our second part and talk about how in the world you got interested in the Iditarod and why you made the documentary. But my question to you in relation to these changes or this audience feedback is, at the top of the show, Alex, you had said that usually a documentary is about something that the filmmaker is thoroughly passionate about. And you had mentioned other folks like Michael Moore and Morgan Spurlock, who are kind of the big-name folks that make other types of documentaries. Maybe they're not necessarily as passionate as the little guys, so to speak. So after you made this movie and, you know, it was out for folks to watch, was it something that you thought people would like, or was it something that you just had to get done because it was a project that you were passionate about and you wanted to do it yourself? So I guess the question is, were you making it for yourself or were you making it for an audience?
And I'm going to cheat a little and say the answer is really both.
Okay.
I knew that there was this feeling that I got whenever I heard about or talked about or saw anything that had to do with the Iditarod. And I wanted, my chief goal was to figure out a way to convey that feeling to an audience. And it's still sometimes hard for me to articulate what that feeling really is. It's a combination of just being in awe of some of the mushers, being in awe of the way the people and dogs are able to triumph over really, really difficult, sometimes unbelievably, unimaginably difficult conditions, an intense love of the dogs, and a feeling that even for people who were into the Iditarod, there were a lot of things about the race that weren't necessarily about the competition that weren't being decimated, that weren't really coming through. So I wanted to do something that would capture a lot of that. And, you know, the Iditarod Trail Committee, every year they do this documentary that they produce, which I guess the Insider crews produce, and then they sell it at Iditarod.com. And those are fantastic, and they have these sweeping, majestic helicopter shots, and they have, you know, all of this great stuff about some of the top five or six racers. And then there's not a lot of stuff about anyone else in the race. And I realized that as exciting and as wonderful as it is to keep track of and follow the top racers, the racers who can win, that it's even more exciting to me to look at the stories of the people in the back of the pack, people in the middle of the pack, and just all of the stuff that goes on around Iditarod that I think most people who aren't there and haven't experienced it don't really have any idea about.
So, Alex, I want one more question here before we close part one of our interview. And I guess it's more of a statement, and maybe you can elaborate a little bit on it. I remember you and I had dinner at a little restaurant here in Wasilla, and you had a camera with you, a little handheld camera. And I remember you saying, this is pretty much what I made my documentary with, a camera very similar to this. And you would be surprised at how small my budget was. And I believe you said it was just a few thousand dollars. What you made your documentary with. Can you expound on that a little bit? You know, when people think about documentaries, they think about the big fancy cameras and, you know, the big film crews and the boom mics and the editors and all of this other stuff that goes into it. But you were pretty much a man with a little camera out on your own 2 feet, and you were making this movie. Can you tell us a little bit about that, in particular the cameras that you used, and a little bit about the budget?
Yeah, the budget was a few thousand dollars. It was mostly for travel and some equipment. The camera that I used on Mush was a little palm held Canon HD camera, and at the time, I believe that it was selling for somewhere in the neighborhood of $700 or $800.
Wow!
I'm very partial to those type of cameras. They're what's referred to as prosumer cameras because they have more features than a typical consumer camera, but not quite as much exact control as you would get in a professional camera. But you can, for example, have You know, you can control white balance, and you can control manually focus, and you're not. It's not like a point and shoot camera where what you see is what you get. Although some of those these days are pretty good also. So I wanted something that would at least look reasonably good. I had a camera that I'd used on an earlier project, which was a Panasonic, that I think does better in low light, but it was a standard def camera, not a, a high def camera. And I remember at the time, the equivalent Panasonic high def camera was about twice as expensive as the Canon. So I couldn't afford that at the time. So I went with the Canon, and it had a separate input for a mic, so I had a very good Sennheiser mic, which I used to record everything. A lot of these palm quarter mics have the little built-in condenser. The cameras have the built-in condenser microphones, which sometimes sound okay, but sometimes sound awful. So anything that you can get where you can feed in an external microphone is a step up. So that's what I used. And one of the reasons I'm partial to cameras like that is that even the relatively small professional cameras, I'm thinking the cameras people might have seen that news crews have where it's small, but it's big enough that it has to be held on someone's shoulder. If you point a camera like that at someone, that's a little bit intimidating. But if you have a little thing, a little camera that you can hold in your palm and you can have just a face-to-face conversation with someone, they will very quickly forget that the camera is there. And in my mind, that lets you have a much more honest interaction with people. And so that's the reason that I'm very partial to those small cameras.
So speaking of which, we're just about out of time for this episode, but I have a recommendation today. It's a documentary, then we'll jump over to Alex. It's called Searching for Sugar Man. I don't know if you've seen this, Alex. It came out in 2012. It is an absolutely amazing story about a singer who they compared to Bob Dylan, who was really a nobody over here in the States, but he was bigger than Elvis over in South Africa. And not to give away the story, but everybody over there thought he had died from this crazy death on stage, and he just became this superstar. And he ended up, you know, changing his entire focus based on that. And what I found was so interesting about that movie was a lot of that documentary, Alex, was made on an iPhone, using a old-timey type app where they, you know, changed the style of the film to look like it was in the 70s. And it's so cool that all these products and ways to tell stories are out there. And I think that sort of goes hand-in-hand with what you were just talking about by making yours with just this little handheld camera and being able to tell your stories. And then this other movie, Searching for Sugar Man, was made primarily on an iPhone. I thought that was so cool. Have you seen that documentary? Do you know the story about Rodriguez?
Yes, I've seen it. It's a very, very good documentary, and people should definitely see it. There's also some questions about the filmmakers may have shaded the truth a little bit.
Right.
And that seems to be a charge you get a lot in popular documentaries. I know that's a charge that's always leveled at Michael Moore and that's leveled frequently at Morgan Spurlock. But just in terms of the story and in terms of watching it unfold, great, great documentary.
So do you have a quick recommendation for us this week, Alex?
I do. I just started watching. There's a new show on HBO, which is called The Night Of, that was put together by Richard Russo and Steve Zalian, which is a story about a guy who is in absolutely the wrong place in the wrong time and winds up being arrested for murder. And it's not clear, or at least it's not clear from the first episode, if he's done it, but it is just absolutely, you know, it just grabs you by the throat. It is so compelling. Also
Excellent.
Scary, so you may not want to watch it alone.
Very good. I'll definitely check that one out for sure. So this was part one of our conversation with Alex Stein about some of his background in making the movie Mush, and you can definitely check that out. We'll put a link over here on the show page. I assume that it's still available, and Alex can get one out to you. Alex, thanks a lot. We'll talk to you next time, okay?
Okay.
All right.